It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Thursdays on cjlo.com.
Every day you hear something new on CFRC. Can you keep up? You need a weekly recap. Catch up with What's Climbing Friday mornings at 10. The charts on CFRC.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC, 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. Democracy Now!
They live in Asda. I don't know. What matters is that they are martyred, torn to pieces. I don't know anything about what happened. Thank God. Thank God.
The death toll in Gaza continues to climb following airstrikes and attacks on Palestinians seeking food and water. Many of the injured were brought to Nasser Hospital, the largest still functioning hospital in Gaza. We'll speak with Dr. Tarek Loubani, who's been volunteering there since June. Then, how Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power. That's the headline of a new New York Times investigation. We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronen Bergman. Finally, to California, where a federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from conducting sweeping immigration raids and racially profiling people in Los Angeles and surrounding areas. Yet ICE raids over the weekend led to hundreds of arrests of farm workers. At least one man has died. We'll speak to the mayor of Oxnard and a student activist who witnessed the raid.
During the immigration raids, ICE and National Guard came to Ventura County, California, and abducted over 200 people, U.S. citizens, documented, undocumented, all across the board. It affected thousands across the area. The message today for others is that ICE is affecting everyone. It doesn't matter what you look like, where you come from. This is something that is devastating all of our communities.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 58,000. As health officials say, over 200 Palestinians were killed over the past 3 days, including at least 28 so far today. On Sunday, an Israeli missile strike killed at least 10 Palestinians, including 6 children, at a water distribution point in Nuseirat refugee camp. 17 others were wounded in the blast. Israel also attacked a market in Gaza City on Sunday, killing at least 17 people. On Saturday, health officials in Gaza reported at least 38 Palestinian aid seekers were killed. Hassan Omran is an ambulance paramedic in Khan Yunis.
Today, more than 150 injuries and more than 20 martyrs around the aid distribution centers. Most of the gunshot injuries we see are in the head or the torso. The Israeli occupation purposely kills and annihilates people. The occupation uses this policy to carry out mass killings by calling on people to get their daily food. Then when these people get there, they get killed in cold blood.
Former Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Olmert and Israeli leader Yair Lapid have denounced a proposal by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to forcibly move Palestinians in Gaza into a so-called humanitarian city to be built on the ruins of Rafah. Olmert and Lapid likened the proposal to forming a concentration camp. Olmert said the plan would also amount to ethnic cleansing. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers fatally beat a 20-year-old Palestinian-American from Tampa, Florida. Sefola Musalet was killed on Friday while visiting family in the village of Al-Masra's Asharqiya. He is reportedly the seventh American killed in the West Bank since October 2023. A second Palestinian, Mohammed al-Shalabi, was shot dead during the settler attack. Musalat's cousin, Sefola, read a statement from the family.
We are devastated that our beloved Sefola Musalat, nicknamed Seif, was brutally beaten to death in our family's land by illegal Israeli settlers who were attempting to steal it. Israeli settlers surrounded Seif for over 3 hours as paramedics attempted to reach him. But the mob of settlers blocked the ambulance and paramedics from providing life-saving aid. After the mob of Israeli settlers cleared, hours later, Seif's younger brother rushed to carry him to the ambulance. Seif was killed and died before reaching the hospital.
A new ship from the Freedom Flotilla Coalition has set sail from Italy with hopes of breaking the siege on Gaza. The Handala's voyage comes just over a month after Israeli forces raided and seized an earlier aid ship, the Madeleine, in international waters. This is the Brazilian activist Tiago Avila, who was detained last month by Israeli forces during the raid.
We believe that if it was not the Madeleine, then the Handala. If it's not the Handala, the next mission that will be bigger will break the siege of Gaza. Because a regime that depends on starving children to death and bombing hospitals, schools, shelters, and residential areas to stay on top of people cannot survive. So we understand that the whole world is uniting against this genocide. The peoples of the world, the planet of 8 billion people, the vast majority, they are so against this violation and they want to do something. So that's why we're here, to do something together. This boat goes with the hearts and minds of millions of people behind it.
In Britain, police arrested at least 71 people in London, Cardiff, and Manchester for publicly supporting Palestine Action, an anti-genocide direct action group that was recently banned under Britain's Terrorism Act. It's now illegal to belong to the group or even express any support for the organization. Police in London said illegal acts include chanting, wearing clothing, or displaying articles such as flags, signs, or logos related to Palestine Action. Individuals arrested could face up to 14 years in prison. In California, a farm worker who fell from the roof of a greenhouse during an immigration raid last week died over the weekend of his injuries. 57-year-old Jaime Alanis had worked at the farm in Camarillo for 10 years and provided for his wife and daughter who live in Mexico. His niece says he'll now be laid to rest in his hometown in Michoacán. The raid Thursday led to a confrontation between protesters defending the workers and ICE agents who tear-gassed crowds, which included children. Jaime Alanis is the first known person to die in an ICE raid as part of Trump's immigration crackdown. This comes as a federal judge in California temporarily blocked the Trump administration Friday from conducting sweeping immigration raids and racially profiling people in Los Angeles and surrounding areas. Judge Mame Uwise Mensa Frimpong said agents are prohibited from targeting people based on their apparent ethnicity, the language they're speaking, their presence at a particular location, or the type of work they're engaged in. The judge also ordered immigration authorities to provide anyone they arrest with immediate access to lawyers. One of the plaintiffs in the case is Brian Gavidia, who was aggressively pushed up against a fence by ICE agents during a raid and questioned as he repeatedly told the agents he was a U.S. citizen. Gavidia spoke at a press conference Friday.
I truly believe that. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in America. I believe in what we stand. I believe in this court system. And I believe that what's going down right now in the United States is wrong. I believe in the Constitution. We are ignoring the Constitution at the very moment. It is not right. We will not stand down. We are all Americans here. We will not allow this to happen. We follow the Constitution.
In more immigration news, Democratic lawmakers blasted the horrific conditions in Florida's new immigration jail in the Everglades, known as Alligator Alcatraz, after visiting the facility Saturday. This is Florida Congress member Maxwell Frost.
Hey, everybody, I just left the Everglades internment camp, the Everglades detention facility for immigrants, and I got to tell you that the conditions are horrible. These are people being caged. 32 people per cage, only 3 toilets for a group of 32 grown men, and where they drink water is from the toilet. It's only a spigot that comes from the toilet, and that's where you also drink water. And, you know, they didn't let us walk fully in. They opened the door and let us look in, and people were yelling at us, help me, help me. I heard somebody in the back yell, I'm a U.S. citizen. We're going to look into that.
The Miami Herald found hundreds of detainees at the Everglades Immigration Prison have no records or criminal charges, contradicting claims by the Trump administration. In Arizona, 2 Tucson area volunteer aid workers are seeking damages after Homeland Security agents dressed in plain clothes pointed assault-style rifles at them, handcuffed and detained them along a border wall road in March. 74-year-old Gail Kokurek, who regularly assists asylum seekers at the border with water, food and medical supplies, is well known and friendly with the regular border agents in the area. She was driving a vehicle with a Samaritan's logo on it at the time of the incident in March. In Vermont, judges ordered the release on bond of 2 jailed immigrant rights leaders. Jose Ignacio Nacho de la Cruz and Heidi Perez were violently arrested last month after being pulled over on the road they organized with the group Migrant Justice. In Texas, the death toll from this month's massive flooding has reached 132. On Sunday, heavy rain and new flooding forced a halt to search efforts. Meanwhile, the New York Times has revealed FEMA did not answer thousands of calls from flood survivors after Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem did not renew contracts for 4 call center companies the day after the flooding. On Monday, July 7th, FEMA received over 16,400 calls. Only about 2,600 calls were answered, about 16% of all calls. In Arizona, a historic lodge at Grand Canyon's North Rim has burned down, along with dozens of other structures, as a pair of wildfires burned more than 45,000 acres of land. The North Rim had been evacuated on Thursday. President Trump's special envoy to Ukraine and Russia, retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, has arrived in Kyiv a day after Trump announced plans to send Patriot missiles and other weapons to Ukraine. This comes as Russia continues to intensify its attacks on Ukraine. On Sunday, Trump criticized Russian President Vladimir Putin, saying, quote, he'll talk so beautifully, then he'll bomb people at night. We don't like that, Trump said. Iranian state media is reporting the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, was slightly injured last month when Israel bombed a meeting site of Iran's Supreme National Security Council. Pezeshkian reportedly suffered leg injuries as he escaped from the underground facility in Tehran. A new UN report warns nearly 5,000 people were killed in Haiti in just the past 9 months. Gang violence has surged beyond the capital of Port-au-Prince. The UN is urging the international community to support the Kenya-led security mission currently deployed in Haiti and to curb the flow of firearms into the country. UN human rights spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani spoke on Friday.
Caught in the middle of this unending horror story are the Haitian people, who are at the mercy of horrific violence by gangs and exposed to human rights violations from the security forces, as well as abuses by the so-called self-defense groups.
On Friday, the State Department fired more than 1,300 workers. The American Foreign Service Association, which represents U.S. diplomats, slammed the firing, saying, quote, losing more diplomatic expertise at this critical global moment is a catastrophic blow to our national interests, unquote. President Trump's continuing to threaten major tariffs on some of the closest trading partners of the United States. On Saturday, Trump threatened to impose 30% tariffs on Mexico and the European Union, effective August 1st. The EU's Trade Commission said such a move would make transatlantic trade, quote, almost impossible. A major rift has emerged within President Trump's MAGA movement over his administration's handling of the case of Jeffrey Epstein, the dead convicted sex trafficker who Trump once called a terrific guy. On Saturday, Trump backed his attorney general, Pam Bondi, days after she released a memo claiming that Epstein did not keep a client list and that no further disclosures would be warranted, despite her previous claims that the client list was on her desk. This reportedly led to a heated confrontation between Bondi and Dan Bongino, FBI deputy director. Bongino did not go to work on Friday and reportedly considered resigning over the issue. In a long social media post on Saturday, Trump urged his supporters to forget about the Epstein files, sparking new outrage within the MAGA movement. Meanwhile, in Congress, Democratic Representative Ro Khanna plans to introduce an amendment to force a vote demanding the full Epstein files be released to the public. Congressmember Khanna wrote, quote, "Why are the Epstein files still hidden? Who are the rich and powerful being protected?" he asked. Over the weekend, President Trump also threatened to revoke the citizenship of U.S.-born comedian Rosie O'Donnell, a longtime critic of the president. Legal experts said such a move would be patently unconstitutional. And former Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has died at the age of 82. He first came to power in the 80s in a military coup and later turned to electoral politics, where in 2015 he became the first ever opposition candidate to win a presidential election in Nigeria. He vowed to combat corruption and insecurity, but widespread violence continued to spread throughout Nigeria and the larger region during his presidency. He served two terms, was succeeded in 2023 by Nigeria's current president, Bola Tinubu. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Negotiations for a Gaza ceasefire deal appear to have stalled, but are ongoing in Doha. The U.S. is backing a 60-day ceasefire with a phased release of hostages, but significant gaps remain between Israeli and Hamas positions. The official death toll in Gaza has topped 58,000, though it's expected to be far higher with people buried in the rubble as Israeli forces continue to target Palestinians seeking aid. On Sunday, an Israeli missile strike killed at least 10 Palestinians, including six children, at a water distribution point in Nuseirat refugee camp. At least 17 others were wounded in the blast. Israel's also attacked a market in Gaza City on Sunday, killing at least 17 people. According to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, nearly 800 people have been killed in Gaza while attempting to access aid just since late May, when the U.S. and Israeli-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, took over most aid distribution sites. On Saturday, at least 27 Palestinians were killed, more than 180 injured, when Israeli forces opened fire on people waiting for humanitarian aid at a distribution site near Rafah. This is Palestinian paramedic Hassan Omran.
Today, more than 150 injuries and more than 20 martyrs around the aid distribution centers. Most of the gunshot injuries we see are in the head or the torso. The Israeli occupation purposely kills and annihilates people. The occupation uses this policy to carry out mass killings by calling on people to get their daily food. Then when these people get there, they get killed in cold blood.
The injured from Saturday's massacre were taken to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. Early this morning, Israeli airstrikes wounded and killed several people. This is Itamad Abu Daka, the aunt of a child injured in the strikes.
They live in Azda. I don't know. What matters is that they are martyred, torn to pieces. I don't know anything about what happened. Thank God. Thank God. What is this child's fault? Was he carrying a weapon? Was he fighting them? Was he fighting? Is he a fighter?
This morning's injured were taken to Nasser Hospital, the largest functioning hospital in Gaza, facing fuel shortages and a widening Israeli offensive in the area. We go now to Nasser Hospital, to Gaza, to speak with Dr. Tarek Lubani, an emergency room medical doctor who has been volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Gaza since June. He's the medical director of the GLIA Project, an organization creating open-source medical devices for low-resource communities. In 2018, Dr. Lubani was among 19 medics shot by the Israeli military in Gaza. In October 2023, Dr. Lubani was arrested for nonviolently protesting, calling for a ceasefire. He's also a Palestinian refugee. Dr. Lubani, welcome back to Democracy Now! Today from Nasser Hospital. Can you describe the injuries, the fatalities that you're seeing?
The injuries are every manner of terrible injuries for a doctor to see. So one of the things that we've grown very accustomed to is, for example, bombings and crush injuries in Gaza. I've been working here for 15 years. However, every day brings a new type of severe and terrible injuries. For example, yesterday, there were gunshot wounds to the head. 2 or 3 days ago, we were noticing especially young men and boys were getting gunshots to the groin. And so every day seems to be a new exercise in the depths of human depravity in terms of targeting men, boys, women, and children, especially in terms of the youngest children. I think every doctor who operates and works in Palestine will tell you that that's the most jarring, the most terrible part of our job is just the war on children on every level.
Can you talk about the injuries you're seeing as a result of people lining up to get aid from the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF, that shadowy Israeli U.S. so-called aid organization that so many international aid organizations have condemned? Talk about what you've seen there and the AP investigation saying they releasing video showing the opening fire on the aid seekers.
There was no surprise to me when I saw the AP video. It was exactly what patients and Palestinians have been telling me and have been telling us for the past month and a half since GHF really started operating. Almost immediately when they started operating, they started massacring civilians. The injury patterns, there are two major injury types. One of them is sniper-style shots, people who are shot very clear, deliberately in the head, especially, or in some other part of the body like the groin. And then the other one is where they just unload some semi-automatic or automatic machine, like a machine gun or a light machine gun, into a crowd of people, where essentially what they do is they open fire on these heavily, densely packed groups of people and end up not just killing and wounding the people who are seeking aid, but people even up to a kilometer away, especially when they're using the heavier weapons. As well, the Israeli army is clearly a part of the massacres. Many of the massacres happen by Israelis and many of them happen by the mercenaries who pretend to be humanitarian aid workers for the GHF. And the Israeli army will also shoot at collections of Palestinians, will fire on tents close to them. So we see all of these types of injuries as well. For example, people who are laying in bed because it's often late at night or early in the morning, who then get shot because of the rampant and wanton firing of bullets. What I end up seeing, like I said, is a lot of head injuries, people who come in essentially brain dead. Even with the best care, they may not survive. However, with the massive shortages, we have shortages of fuel, which means that we have shortages of oxygen. We also have shortages of equipment, which means that we don't have basic supplies to treat our patients. Yesterday, when we had one of these massacres, not an aid massacre, but a tent massacre, yet another new form of depravity we didn't know before this war. And I was on the ground trying to intubate, to provide advanced assistance to a patient while I was on my stomach on the floor and the patient was on his back on the floor. So what we see is these reckless types of injuries in addition to specifically targeted and sniper type injuries that result in literally dozens of deaths every single day, if not hundreds, and also hundreds of injuries that then we have a very hard time treating because of the severe lack of equipment.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Tariq Lavani, about Israeli forces targeting Palestinian medical staff. I mean, you have doctors detained like Dr. Abu Safia, if you have heard anywhere where he is. And then we've gotten reports most recently about threats to medical staff at Nasser, where you are. An email medical staff are receiving threatening texts. Do you know anything about this?
Yes, absolutely. We are, as medical staff, we are a number one public enemy for the Israeli army. We know that. It's been clear since the beginning, and Palestinian medical workers have said that. Over 1,500 medical workers in Palestine have been killed in the last 2 years. At least 350 remain in Israeli captivity today. Many, many more people are disappeared. And it is clear that there's a war on the entire medical system. At the very best, we received drips and drabs of medical equipment. Yesterday, I was reviewing the inventory so that we could try to figure out what to prioritize bringing in. The reality is that over 80% of all essential medications are completely stocked out. And that's figures that, you know, I see day to day. That's figures that the Ministry of Health, the World Health Organization are all releasing. There's no secrets here. And of course, when I came into Gaza and when other medical teams come into Gaza, if any of them have anything that resembles medical equipment that could be used on others, it is confiscated at the border. So yes, we as a medical system are targeted. The texts you're talking about are texts that were received by everybody at the Nasser Medical Complex yesterday who had a cell phone, especially the medical team, telling them that they were de facto targets of the Israeli military and that unless they turned themselves in and turned who even knows in, then they would be considered as hostile enemies.
So we're talking about the massive injuries, the dead. What about the condition of people starving?
Every single patient I see is in a state of starvation at this point. And, you know, I know starvation. I've seen, you know, people go on hunger strike and things like this. I myself have previously been on hunger strike. I've seen people who haven't been able to eat for a week or two or three. That's not what I'm seeing here. What I'm seeing here is people who have completely depleted all of their protein stores, all of their fat stores, who are literally skin and bones that I've only seen in textbooks and history videos. And when they come, you know, they tell me when I ask sometimes out of curiosity, well, what took you to the aid sites? And they tell me about how hungry they are. They tell me about how hungry their families are. Like one man just two or three days ago who was shot in the head. He was brain dead when I saw him. And when I asked his family why he went, they said because his four children were so starved that he finally decided to risk it. Of course, ended up losing his life over it. The starvation levels affect 100% of people in Gaza. Nobody at all is spared. Every single person is hungry. And the most incredible thing to me was how quickly it set in, even for people like me, who arrived well-fed and healthy, and then immediately started to experience these severe caloric deficits from the first day. So not only are we not receiving food, not receiving enough calories, the food we receive is not nutritious. We're allowed to eat rice. We're allowed to sometimes eat lentils. You can't raise babies on that. You know, there is no policy that justifies baby formula being denied entry into a place like Gaza. And yet I visited the pediatric malnutrition wards. It is a horror show of little children who really should be thriving and who are withering away one moment at a time while their parents don't know what to do and sometimes are willing to take the risks to go to these aid sites so they can try to feed them.
Can you talk about the push to move people south, people who've been displaced over and over again? We just had a headline that former Israeli Prime Ministers Ehud Olmert and Yair Lapid have denounced a proposal by Netanyahu's government to forcibly move Palestinians in Gaza into a so-called humanitarian city to be built on the ruins of Rafah. Both have called it a concentration camp. You have Yair Lapid saying that if they cannot exit, it is a concentration camp. And talk about this procession of humanity south.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that Israeli politicians have finally come to the same realization that Palestinian healthcare workers and activists have been talking about for, at this point, over 2 months. This is not a new idea. It is clear that the Israelis have been trying to trap Palestinians in concentration camps. I mean, for all intents and purposes, Gaza was an open-air prison before the war, and Palestinians had been warning about the possibility of that turning into a concentration camp at any moment. So yes, I'm glad that they've now arrived to this conclusion. I'm glad that the Western world is now taking the Palestinian warning seriously about a concentration camp. What the Israelis have been proposing to do now for at least the last 6 months is to try to put all Palestinians into a small area where they have full and complete oversight, where they can dictate life or death and where they can dictate all of the terms and conditions under which that life or death happened. And of course, as we see from the GHF's operating philosophy, they would be able to kill anybody who they wanted at any point. I mean, right now, the GHF receives people who they run through all of these security checks, and despite that, is murdering them, gunning them down with wanton, reckless abandon. So I think that this, the idea of a concentration camp is predicated on forcing people out. You know, there's nothing voluntary about it, as some Israeli politicians talk about, on forcing people out by removing all of the ingredients of life. We've seen them remove clean water. There's no clean water in Gaza for any intents and purposes. There's no food really anywhere, and it's getting worse by the day. There's no fuel. The fuel shortages that I mentioned earlier are yet worse than they've ever been. And all of this has been resulting in hundreds of additional deaths each day. I see patients who are shot every single day. I see patients who are blown up every single day. But what's new over the past month is that now I also see patients who are starving to death or who have starved to death. I see little babies, which are often reported, sometimes not. And I also see elderly people, people with immune conditions, people with chronic conditions. This is what the Israelis count on to force people into the concentration camp. However, they are so incapable of even pretending for one moment that they would treat anybody humanely, that I think based on what we see from the GHF, Palestinians are nowhere near falling for this trap.
Finally, like every other doctor who's worked in Gaza, you've treated children. There's a new acronym that has been coined since Israel's siege of the territory, WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. Can you end by telling us some of their stories?
Yeah, I will. You know, I always thought that Palestine was something that I needed to understand what else was going on in the world. What I've come to understand and see by stories like Wounded Child, No Surviving Family, is that Palestine is the central issue, not just of our time, but of the past 100 years. Everything we see happening in Palestine, like the treatment these children are receiving, is what's going to happen in every other domain. And that's, you know, an idea, not one that I've come up with, but that talented analysts and historians have been talking about for a while, such as Dr. Guicciardo or Dr. Poder, who both analyze these and talk about them. In terms of wounded children, basically what we see a lot of the time, what I've stopped doing for the past several months now, I've stopped asking any child I see about whether they're there with somebody or whether there's anybody there for them. You know, it gets so busy. We get literally dozens of patients at a time because of these massacres. And so sometimes we need somebody to go grab blood for this little 2-year-old or 1-year-old who's on the floor. And when I ask, you know, where's this boy's family? Where's this girl's family? Often I get the same acronym back. Dr. Tarek, this is a wounded child, no surviving family. And so we try to treat them. They're often too young to understand that their parents are dead, but they sit there struggling, wounded. You know, we've seen so many. We've seen a flood of videos. Like, for example, just 2 days ago, a child who I saw who had more than half of her body surface area burned, and where I was looking for somebody to comfort her, and there was simply nobody. And so I picked her up and just held her for a few minutes until there was somebody else who could come to hold her so I could go back to treating my other patients. All I could think is that this story, there are tens of thousands at this point of people, of children in Gaza who've lost one or both of their family. Understanding what's happening to them is understanding war as it's being proposed for the rest of the world.
Dr. Tarek Labani, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian-Canadian doctor, emergency room medical physician, volunteering at Nasser Hospital in Gaza since June, medical director of the GLIA Project, an organization creating open-source medical devices for low-resource settings. Coming up, how Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power. That's the headline of a new New York Times investigation. We'll speak with a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Ronen Bergman, back in 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Something to say by Fatoumata Diawara, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. How Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power. That's the headline of a new investigation in the New York Times Magazine published Friday. The co-authors write, quote, "Why, after nearly 2 years, has the war yet to reach a definitive conclusion? Why did Israel frequently turn away chances for de-escalation, instead expanding its military ambitions to Lebanon, to Syria, now to Iran? Why has the war dragged on even as the leadership of Hamas was decapitated and more Israelis called for a ceasefire?" Unquote. The authors write they interviewed over 110 officials in Israel, the U.S., and the Arab world, in addition to reviewing scores of government documents and records to investigate these questions. They go on to say Netanyahu, quote, "When an extended ceasefire was finally forged in January, he broke the truce in March, in part to keep his coalition intact. The cost of delay has been high. With each passing week, the delay has meant death to hundreds of Palestinians and horror to thousands more. It also meant at least eight more hostages died in captivity," unquote. We're joined now by Ronen Bergman. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning Israeli investigative reporter and staff writer for The New York Times Magazine, co-author of this piece in the magazine. Can you lay out your findings, Ronen, how Netanyahu prolonged the war in Gaza to stay in power?
Thank you, Amy. I think it's, of course, very hard to differentiate between the different vectors in such a, it's not just the war in Gaza. It's a regional war, something that started with Hamas attacking Israel on October 7th, and Hezbollah attacking Israel on October 8th, and then it erupted to a regional war. And some of the things that Netanyahu has done, I think any Israeli prime minister would do, countering, of course, following Hamas horrific attack. But some of what he did was clearly motivated, at least partly, by his coalition motivation and his fear of the integrity of the coalition. His coalition is dependent on the ultra-right parties that again and again threaten Netanyahu that if he goes for a deal, if he goes for a ceasefire that will bring back the hostages, a ceasefire that could bring, you know, a new page to this so painful, bloody war. If he does that, then they will disassemble the government. One of the scenes that we are describing, this is just a case study, together with my colleagues, the Jerusalem bureau chief of the New York Times, Patrick Kingsley, and the reporter for the New York Times in Jerusalem, Nathan Odenheimer, is happening in April 24. You just quoted something that happened almost a year after, which repeated that. But in April 24, Benjamin Netanyahu, together with his small cabinet and national security and military advisors, agreed to a deal that would put the war to a halt. It would have weeks of ceasefire. It will have an exchange of Palestinian prisoners for Israeli hostages. And it will bring hope for negotiation, for cessation of hostilities, withdrawal of the Israeli military, and possibly also something that Netanyahu has thrived for many, many years to get and was the closest of any prime minister, which is the normalization of relations with the most important Arab country, Saudi Arabia, that was willing to do that. He was about to bring this to the larger cabinet. He says to advisors, "I'm not putting this on the agenda. I want to put this as a surprise, or not to let the more extremist ministers to oppose and coordinate." And when he was just about to do that, the Ministry of Treasury, Bezalel Smotrich, one of the ultra-right members of the cabinet, entered the room, bursting, and said, "Prime Minister, I heard that you are going to put a proposal for a ceasefire the details bothered him. And he says, I just wanted you to know, Prime Minister, I wanted you to know that if you do that, you do not have a government, meaning that they will leave the coalition and it will be disassembled. And Netanyahu said, no, I was not going to put anything on the table. And he whispered to his aides, don't put this offer forward. This happened in a time when it was not just sabotaging the possible hostage deal and a possible ceasefire deal. Of course, ending the misery of the hostages, of the millions of Palestinians, bringing back the hostages, saving the life of many Israeli soldiers, and maybe be a page turn to a better future for the region. But it could also bring normalization for Netanyahu, something that he really wanted. Now, Amy, it's not that Netanyahu doesn't want the hostage to come back. It's not that Netanyahu doesn't want normalization with Saudi Arabia. He does, I'm sure. But there are things he wants more, or maybe more precisely, things that he fears more. And that is the integrity of the coalition. And repeatedly, again and again, Prime Minister Netanyahu put the integrity of the coalition, the safety of his continuous rule of the government and the state, while he's up on severe corruption charges, he put this as a first priority ahead of any other priority.
So just today, he was back in court after coming to the United States, back in an Israeli court, saying, you know, he should not be tried because he has to deal with national security issues. You write, for Netanyahu, the immediate rewards of not having a peace deal have been rich. He's amassed more control over the Israeli state than at any other point in his 18-year tenure as prime minister. He successfully prevented a state inquiry that would investigate his own culpability, saying the fallout must wait until the Gaza war ends, even as the defense minister, army chief, domestic spy master, and several top generals all either have been fired or have resigned. And you talk about how he attends court up to three times a week for his corruption trial. His government now moving to fire the attorney general who oversees the prosecution. If you can go more into that and investigation into how October 2023 happened with Netanyahu himself approving millions of dollars brought in, what, by Qatari officials to Gaza to support Hamas.
Yeah. Let me start with the latter, with your permission, Amy. Netanyahu said publicly and privately for years that he sees Hamas as an asset. How come? Because once you have Hamas, an extreme jihadist fundamentalist regime in Gaza that does not recognize the right of Israel to exist. And now we see from Hamas secret protocols that were all about eradicating the state of the Jews. They wanted to destroy Israel. They wanted to coordinate the regional war. Once you have something like that in Gaza, Netanyahu can say to the world, why do you want me to negotiate with the Palestinians? How can I negotiate with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank when you have something such an entity in Gaza? And he saw Hamas as an asset. He convinced the Qataris to funnel many, many hundreds of millions of dollars to help the Hamas government in Gaza, to help them survive. While at the same time, as we uncover, during the last year since he became prime minister again in early 23 and until the war, he pushed back again and again and again on any idea of his military chiefs and the leaders of the intelligence community to confront Hamas, to assassinate their leaders. As late as October 1st, so a week before Hamas attack, he pushed back on ideas to confront Yahya Sinwar, the mastermind behind October 7, and said, you should keep them quiet. I have other priorities like the normalization with Saudi Arabia. So the bottom line, his willingness to not just let Hamas thrive, but help Hamas thrive, not to force him to have international pressure to negotiate two-state solution, led to Hamas fortified its rule and secretly planning the October 7th surprise. Now, after the October 7th surprise, everybody was sure that Netanyahu is going to be ousted, he's going to be expelled from politics after bringing a year of an attempt to weaken the judiciary, to fire the attorney general, what he's trying to do now as well. After a year of weakening the military that was, you know, divided and disassembled in some of the units because of the judicial overhaul, everybody thought, we're sure that he's going down in politics. That's the end of his political career. But Netanyahu prevailed. He used smart, sophisticated, sometimes brutal, sometimes inhonest politics, together with sophisticated propaganda machine working in Israel, together with confronting the judicial system. He promised to make himself available for his trial, but then when the trial came, he's doing or using any excuse not to be there. And at the peak of that, and I think this is the biggest triumph of his career, he was able to flip the war, hit Hezbollah, and you know, we have to mention the fact that Hezbollah was the first to launch unprovoked attack on Israel. And then, and this is maybe the peak of his diplomatic and political career, convinced President Trump just recently on their call on June 9th to agree that Israel will strike Iran, and then to convince President Trump to join the strike and sending the B-2 to bomb the Iranian nuclear sites.
Renan, we just have 30 seconds.
2 years, he's almost... Sorry?
We just have 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I'm saying, and now after 2 years, he is stronger than ever since October 7th. And some say maybe even strong enough after all that happened to rewin the elections. And it's not a coincidence that he's trying to weaken the gatekeepers and fire all of them just before maybe announcing elections.
Renan Bergman, I want to thank you for being with us. Israeli Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times co-authored the investigation in the magazine How Netanyahu Prolonged the War in Gaza to Stay in Power. His book is titled Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Coming up, we speak to the mayor of Oxnard and a migrant rights activist about the immigration raids this weekend where a farm worker has died of his injuries and hundreds have been rounded up. Back in 20 seconds.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. Living is easy with eyes closed. Misunderstanding all we see. It's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me.
Santa Cecilia playing their rendition of Strawberry Fields Forever, a tribute to migrant workers in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to California, where a farm worker who fell from the roof of a greenhouse during an immigration raid last week died over the weekend of his injuries. 57-year-old Jaime Alanis had worked at the farm in Camarillo for 10 years, providing for his wife and daughter who live in Mexico. His niece says he'll now be laid to rest in his hometown of Michoacan. Jaime Alanis is the first known person to die during an immigration raid since Trump returned to office. He reportedly called his family during the raid to tell them he was hiding before falling about 30 feet from the roof. The raid there Thursday led to an hours-long standoff between protesters and federal border agents who blocked the roads with military-style vehicles and tear gas, community members, including children, as crowds attempted to protect dozens of farm workers from arrest. This is one of the protesters.
These guys showed up all tough, cowards, and they've already tried to push us out. But there's more of us here now than there were before. At the end of the day, they're the ones coming from over there. They're not from here. Farmers who work here take more of a beating than anyone else. They're not the ones who deserve this f***ing treatment.
The Department of Homeland Security said over 300 immigrants were detained in dual raids on cannabis farms and agricultural fields in Camarillo and the coastal city of Carpinteria. Among those taken into custody were at least 14 immigrant children. The United Farm Workers Union issued a statement in response saying, quote, farm workers are excluded from basic child labor laws, and it's unfortunately not uncommon for teenagers to work in the fields. To be clear, detaining and deporting children is not a solution for child labor, they said. This comes as a federal judge in Los Angeles Friday issued an order temporarily blocking the Trump administration from conducting sweeping immigration raids and racially profiling people in Los Angeles and surrounding areas. Judge Mame Wuse Mensa Frimpong said agents are prohibited from targeting people based on their apparent ethnicity, the language they're speaking, their presence at a particular location, or the type of work they're engaged in. The judge also ordered immigration authorities to provide anyone they arrest with immediate access to lawyers. One of the plaintiffs in the case, Brian Gavidia, who was aggressively pushed against a fence by ICE agents during a raid and questions as he repeatedly told the agents he was a U.S. citizen, spoke at a news conference Friday.
I truly believe that. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in America. I believe in what we stand. I believe in this court system. And I believe that what's going down right now in the United States is wrong. I believe in the Constitution. We are ignoring the Constitution at the very moment. It is not right. We will not stand down. We are all Americans here. We will not allow this to happen. We follow the Constitution.
For more, we're joined by two guests. Angel Marie Taylor is an undergraduate student in her senior year at California State University, Channel Islands, a volunteer with 805 Immigrant Coalition. 805 Immigrant Coalition was present during the federal immigration raid in Camarillo. And Lewis MacArthur is mayor of Oxnard, California, about 10 miles from Camarillo. He was previously the police commander of Oxnard and worked on the police force there for 35 years, now speaking out against the ICE raid, saying they're, quote, aggressive, demonstrating insensitivity toward the direct impact on our community. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Angel Marie Taylor. Describe the raid that you saw. You are an eyewitness.
It was almost unlike anything that we had ever seen before. Most of the protesters out there are your average people. We are average community members who have been volunteering our time to patrol our own streets to keep each other safe from these ICE agents, ICE thugs, I would say, who have been operating entirely outside of the law, not identifying themselves, not allowing us our rights. And that's just us as protesters who come to witness and document these raids. That's not even to speak to the even more intense violence that the farm workers themselves experience in the blocked off area. As you mentioned, where over 300 people from our community were taken.
And Mayor, if you can talk about what is happening, you're the former police chief. Now you are the mayor of Oxnard. In a social media post, you wrote, "While this matter is taking place outside the jurisdiction of Oxnard, I'm increasingly mindful that many of the facility's employees are likely from Oxnard and are seeking refuge in their vehicles amidst the high temperatures, raising concerns about the safety and well-being of those individuals." Can you talk about the Oxnard residents, Lewis MacArthur, who were targeted?
Yes, absolutely. You know, what we're seeing is these unjust and harmful actions by ICE officials without following any due process. And we had it hit home here on several instances. As you may know, Oxnard is the largest city in Ventura County. Ventura County has about 830,000 residents. Oxnard has about a quarter of those residents. And many of them, when I heard about what was unfolding there at the Glass House in Camarillo, which is right next door to us, just a few miles away, I know, having grown up here in Oxnard, the many of the individuals that worked at the Glass House were Oxnard residents. And so that's what caused me to turn back around. I was headed to Los Angeles to come back and to be present. And what I also saw is just a lot of insensitivity. I was personally receiving phone calls because my cell phone number was shared from people that were inside the facility that were taking refuge in their cars and with the sun as strong as it was that day. And the number of hours that the operation lasted, it became very evident as to what I had stated previously, that these actions are very harmful to our community, to individuals. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about parents, just like the gentleman that passed because of the chaotic actions of ICE. I'm not saying that the ICE agents killed the gentleman, but because of the chaotic actions, they caused this man and others to seek refuge, and this man fell down from the roof head first, from what I understand, and died as a result of that. And then we had people that actually sought refuge as well, not only in their cars, but also on the dirt field and covered themselves up with dirt. And that was information that was being relayed or trying to be relayed to these ICE agents. But the fact that they work in secrecy without a person willing to interact while I was there on site, there was no deliberate intent by anyone from ICE to come out and just engage in some dialogue with us so that we can relay this information. There was none of that. And that's what we're talking about, is just a lack of due process. And as I have asserted, like any other police officer, with the tenure of time that I spent in the police force, I've arrested some of the most just persons that had committed atrocious crimes in our city, from murderers to folks that have sexually assaulted others, and just a number of other felonious crimes. But nonetheless, those individuals were afforded a due process following the 5th and 14th Amendment of our Constitution. They were afforded the right to see an attorney, to consult with an attorney, to stand before a judge, and to be made available an opportunity to defend themselves. And that's not what we're seeing now. We're seeing people quickly being expedited out of here. And that's why the errors are occurring. And for us as a community, what it's doing, not only is it impacting our economy, but it's directly impacting children who are oftentimes left with our mom and dad here to care for them. And this is putting a tremendous amount of strain. We're seeing a lot of nonprofits come out and help and stepping up. But we can't endure this much longer.
Mayor,
and this is what is we've been done.
I want to go to Angel Marie Taylor. You're an undergraduate student in your senior year at California State University. On Thursday, you were at the raid with John Carvalho, a faculty member at your university who was arrested and remains detained. I want to turn to him speaking the night before the raid, Wednesday, at the Camarillo City Council meeting's public comment period.
My name is John Caravello, and I'm a professor at CSU Channel Islands. I'm also a longtime organizer with Ventura County Tenants Union, and more recently a volunteer with VC Defensa. Many of my students are undocumented, and many of their families are undocumented. It's my responsibility to protect them, and so I've been patrolling the city streets, following armed, masked thugs trying to kidnap my neighbors. Many call these neighbors illegal, but let's talk for a second about what's really illegal. When the U.S. bombed civilian nuclear sites like they did in Iran late last month, it's illegal. When the U.S. provides weapons to an apartheid state to fuel a genocide like it continues to do in Palestine, it is illegal. And today, armed mass thugs are bending the knee to just follow orders to kidnap, imprison, and deport our neighbors to countries that we destabilize, that we have under the thumb of our political and economic domination, whose soil we destroy with pesticide-ridden bananas, whose leaders we depose, and whose people our media continue to dehumanize. Who are we to constrict the movement of our fellow human beings? Who are we to judge how people choose to live? ICE is not welcome here, just like the U.S. is not welcome in other countries. And you, our elected officials, should swear them off, if not in policy, then in spirit, to at the very least pay back your undocumented community members for picking your strawberries. No one is illegal. Power to the people.
So that is John Caravello, who is a faculty member at California State University, Channel Islands, where Angel Marie Taylor, you teach. He was arrested the next day. Can we just have 30 seconds? He hasn't been released yet?
No, Professor Caravello hasn't been released. And as you've heard in that public comment, he has always used his voice to speak up for those around him. Myself as a student coming from an immigrant background, like most other students here in CSU Channel Islands, Professor Caravello has been continuously targeted because of his outspoken views to defend his community. And he was one of the protesters on the ground who was helping other protesters amidst the violence.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this. As the judge in Los Angeles ruled that migrants can no longer be rounded up in Los Angeles without cause, Angel Marie Taylor, student and volunteer with 805 Immigrant Coalition, thank you for being with us. And Luis MacArthur, mayor of Oxnard, 10 miles from Camarillo. Previously, the police commander of Oxnard. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I'm being completely honest now, okay? Homelessness makes me uncomfortable. But then I think...